and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Congressman Ted Lieu, who serves on the House Judiciary Committee, and today called upon the House Judiciary Committee to open an investigation into the allegations by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and a second accuser, Deborah Ramirez, whose story of graphic and naked sexual harassment alleged by Brett Kavanaugh at a drunken party of undergraduates at Yale. In addition, a third accuser has come forward who is represented by Michael Avenatti, and she has made similar accusations which Congressman Lieu feels are sufficiently serious that together they raise the question of whether Judge Kavanaugh should keep his current job on the Federal Appeals Court, let alone the Supreme Court, and whether there are grounds for his impeachment. We will also look into how much the White House is leaking reports that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who oversees the Mueller investigation, is about to resign, and is that a distraction from the chaos and uncertainty now facing the nomination of President Trump's second pick for the Supreme Court. He is expected to testify on Thursday amid growing calls by Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee for an FBI investigation into the accusations from an increasing number of women coming forward who are questioning Kavanaugh's honesty and fitness to serve on the highest courts in the land. Then, with more chaos gripping the leadership of the Department of Justice, with an increasingly tenuous Attorney General Trump claims he does not have, and a Deputy Attorney General Trump is threatening to fire while pressuring him to resign, we will speak with a veteran of the Department of Justice who served for 26 years, assuming a series of management positions, including Acting Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Bill Yeomans, a senior fellow for justice at the Alliance for Justice, who is now a lecturer at Columbia Law School, joins us to discuss the repercussions of the New York Times story which alleged Rod Rosenstein considered wearing a wire to record Trump and that he questioned whether the 25th Amendment should be invoked to remove Trump from office. We'll assess whether Trump is trying to force Rod Rosenstein to resign at their upcoming showdown meeting on Thursday so that he can replace him under the Vacancy Act and thereby neuter the Mueller investigation, as opposed to firing him, which would mean Trump would need Senate confirmation for a replacement of Rosenstein. Then finally, we will speak with Lena Schwarenstein, the Fair Courts campaign director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as the director of strategic engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw judicial nominations. She joins us to discuss the apparent determination by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to, quote, plow through with Thursday's hearing, in spite of growing calls for an FBI investigation into the increasing number of accusers coming forward, raising the likelihood that Kavanaugh is guilty of perjury. With Dr. Ford having been denied her request to speak after Kavanaugh and be questioned by Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee and have Kavanaugh's friend Mark Judge testify, we will assess the extent to which the Republicans are stacking the decks against her. And joining us now is Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was also appointed as an assistant whip for the Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Ted Lieu.
Hello, Ian. Honored to be on your show.
Well, thank you. And Congressman, you're calling upon the House Judiciary Committee, of which you are a member, to open an investigation into the allegations from both Christine Blasey Ford and the new allegations from the New Yorker article by Deborah Ramirez to determine whether Judge Kavanaugh should keep his current job or whether there are grounds for impeachment. So we're not really even talking about the job that he's up for, which is a Supreme Court job. You feel that this is serious enough that we should be looking into whether he's fit to serve in his current job on the appeals court.
That is correct. The House Judiciary Committee is where all impeachment proceedings would originate. And these allegations, if true, are not just disqualifying for a Supreme Court nominee, they're also disqualifying for a sitting federal judge. And I also note there's actually a third accuser, a client of Michael Avenatti and based on the background that has been reported publicly, she's also had a security clearance in the past. So we right now have, it appears to be, three women who have stepped forward.
And what's the status of the third woman? That is a breaking news story?
We know from Michael Avenatti's tweets today, where he described the background of the third woman, and he's been releasing emails he's been exchanging with the Senate Judiciary Council. So we don't know the identity yet, and that remains to be seen who it is.
So what do you think is going to happen here, given that Thursday is supposed to be the day that Dr. Ford is going to testify? Senator Feinstein is asking for the FBI investigation into both cases now, and presumably a third now that you've mentioned this one, third one. I mean, at what point do the Republicans stop resisting the obvious, which is that the FBI should be looking into all of this?
If the president and the Republicans were actually interested in the truth, they would demand an FBI investigation right now. But because they're resisting it, that's why I'm calling on the House Judiciary Committee, on which I sit, to start investigating, because it's pretty clear to me that we need at least an investigation. These women have stepped forward. They've shown their courage. I believe Christine Ford, as well as Deborah Ramirez, and the least we can do is give them an investigation.
And of course, this, today is such an extraordinarily busy news day. What do you make of what's going on with Rod Rosenstein? It seems to me that what the White House is trying to do, since they leaked the idea that he's about to be fired or about to resign, clearly the White House would prefer that he resign. That way they could use the Vacancy Act to replace him and the Attorney General, as opposed to if he's fired, the Vacancy Act doesn't apply.
There's just been so much chaos with the Trump administration. It almost feels like we're in one long extended episode of their TV show Veep. But what we see today is, I think, an attempt to distract from the Kavanaugh hearings with this potential story that Rod Rosenstein had resigned, when in fact he had not. And he's going to meet with the president on Thursday. We'll see what happens in that meeting. It's not clear to me Rod Rosenstein is going to resign. I think he may force the president to try and fire him. And if that happens, I believe that would be potentially obstruction of justice.
And again, I'm speaking with Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was also appointed as an assistant whip for the Democratic Caucus. So do you think there's a possibility that the president will cut his losses here and nominate maybe Amy Coney Barrett? Apparently he's telling friends that he's basically saying, you know, I never wanted Kavanaugh all along. He was foisted on me by the Republican establishment. I always wanted Judge Thomas Hardiman, who his sister, Marianne Trump Barry, recommended. Are you hearing rumors to that extent that he may cut his losses? And or is he going to, as he said today at the UN, I'm going to stand by Kavanaugh?
I think the president will continue standing by Kavanaugh until two Republican senators tell him that he should nominate someone else, and then he's going to fold immediately, because he doesn't get a vote in this confirmation process. It's the senators that do, and it just takes two Republicans to show courage, and we'll get another nominee.
So do you think that we haven't heard from the two women, McCaskey and Collins, right? What more evidence do they need? Isn't this pretty much in their face?
I believe if Dr. Christine Ford testifies on Thursday and appears credible to the American public, then I do think we'll get a new nominee, because I think it'll be difficult for a majority of U.S. Senate to confirm Kavanaugh if there's a credible allegation of sexual assault against him. And this is on top of what we may hear from additional women who have stepped forward.
Well, just in closing, I know you've got a busy day, Congressman Ted Lieu. Going back to your call for the House Judiciary Committee to begin investigations into these allegations to determine whether Judge Kavanaugh should be keeping his current job on the appeals court and whether there are grounds for impeachment, what kind of response are you getting? I take it, Chairman Goodlatte, my guess would be he's behaving like the Republicans in the Senate, which is they just want to plow on through as the Majority Leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, said.
A session for the House of Representatives starts tomorrow, so I will talk to Chairman Goodlatte tomorrow. The House Judiciary Committee is uniquely suited for this job because this is one thing that our committee and our committee staff do. We have in the past impeached federal judges. It's not something that's unknown to this committee, and it's pretty clear that that White House certainly isn't doing the appropriate investigation, so I do believe our committee needs to.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Congressman Ted Lieu.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was also appointed as an assistant whip for the Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the chaos gripping the leadership at the Justice Department. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bill Yeomans, who's a senior fellow for justice at the Alliance for Justice. He's now a lecturer at Columbia Law School and previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law, and also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice before assuming a series of management positions, including acting assistant attorney general. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Yeomans.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks, Bill. And what do you make of the chaos at the DOJ? Obviously, it's an unusual situation to have the President of the United States essentially at war with the DOJ and the FBI, but it's reached a point where the President himself has made the top people in the DOJ, including the Attorney General himself, his enemies, and he castigates them constantly. So, you know, he's almost fulfilling the necessity of having to fire people because he doesn't have an attorney general he can work with. So, in other words, he's created his own problem and then he now seeks to profit from it. At least that's the way I see it. How do you see it?
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, I agree that the combat between the president and the leadership of the Department of Justice is extraordinary. And it is all centered around one thing. We shouldn't forget that the Department of Justice has a broad mandate. It does all kinds of law enforcement, policy work, things like that. And the leadership of the Department of Justice has continued with that. But what the president is concerned about, obviously, is the Russia investigation. And this is all about the Russia investigation. He's been incredibly upset with Jeff Sessions for having recused himself. He thinks that the attorney general was supposed to protect him from the Russia investigation, not conduct the Russia investigation. And Sessions stepped aside, and the president will not forgive him. That left Rod Rosenstein, of course, the deputy attorney general, in charge of the investigation, and he appointed the special counsel, Robert Mueller. And the president has not hesitated to say out loud through Twitter things that demonstrate his hostility toward the investigation and toward the people who are conducting it. And that really has led to what is an extraordinary situation where you have the president on an almost daily basis on Twitter condemning the people who are conducting the investigation. But then these people are going ahead and trying to conduct the investigation as best as possible. So, you know, this threat now to fire Rod Rosenstein or to accept his resignation, we don't know which is really happening, if either, is extraordinary because you know, the focus has been primarily on Robert Mueller and whether the president will fire Mueller. But Rosenstein is the guy who has the authority to make all the final calls on the investigation. So while he doesn't do day-to-day supervision of Mueller's Russia investigation, he has the authority to block anything Mueller wants to do. So, for instance, if Mueller wants to issue a subpoena and Rosenstein doesn't want him to, then Rosenstein can stop it. Same thing with, for instance, sending a report to Congress. It's entirely up to Rosenstein whether a report that Mueller produces from the Russia investigation goes to Congress. So Rosenstein is the crucial guy here. And if Trump is able to remove him from office or get him to leave his office and to replace him with somebody who is much more sympathetic to Trump's view of the investigation, it could have extraordinary repercussions for the investigation. And what it might mean is that the president would not have to fire Robert Mueller. He could stymie Mueller's investigation through a series of actions by his new deputy, who could just basically say no to steps that Mueller wants to take.
Well, all of this, of course, was accelerated by the recent New York Times story that Rod Rosenstein and some others dispute, where he is alleged to have suggested wearing a wire to record private conversations with the president, and also he mused about invoking the 25th Amendment, or at least organizing the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment. What did you make of that? I guess you could put it in the category of the masthead of the New York Times without fear or favor. They've been doing some pretty damaging stories about the White House, but this one, a lot of people thought, was kind of a gift to the White House.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to know what happened there, and it does seem to me that you know, these statements were purportedly made during a period of real chaos. I mean, Rosenstein had not been in office for very long. You know, he was trying to figure out what to do with the Russia investigation, and I think you know, the story is he was sitting around with his aides and trying to sort through it all, and they threw out a lot of stuff. And it's just not clear, you know, in what context these comments were made. And I think one of the things that gives me obvious pause, first of all, the notion of wearing a wire into the Oval Office strikes me as somewhat absurd, but also the notion of invoking the 25th Amendment, you know, ultimately it would require a two-thirds vote both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And that, you know, simply was not a realistic option. So the suggestion that Rosenstein made these comments seriously with some intent to follow through is fairly hard to accept.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Yeomans, who's a senior fellow for justice at the Alliance for Justice. He's also a lecturer at Columbia Law School and previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law, and also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice before assuming a series of management positions, including acting Assistant Attorney General of the United States. So, Bill, at this point, you seem to have a situation where if Rosenstein resigns, then the president has the ability to put in a new acting attorney general, and, or actually an attorney general, get rid of Sessions under the Vacancy Act. But if he's fired, that's not so clear. Is that, am I right on that?
Yeah, that's right. The Vacancy Act is clear that the president can replace someone who resigns with any official who has gone through Senate confirmation. So that would mean someone from another agency. It could be someone from the Department of Justice. He could bring in someone from the Department of Agriculture, so long as that person is Senate confirmed. The act, though, is not clear on whether or not the president has that authority if he fires someone. I think the better view is that he probably cannot replace someone who he fires with an acting person. And that has consequences here, that the line of succession gets fairly complicated. If he can fire Rosenstein and replace him with someone of his own choosing, That's obviously what he would like to do. He could put someone in there who is sympathetic to his view of the Russian investigation and stifle it. In the natural course, though, if he's not able to invoke the Vacancies Act and to bring in his own replacement, the supervision of the Russian investigation would fall to the Solicitor General, Noel Francisco. It would normally fall to the Associate Attorney General, but there is no confirmed Associate Attorney General. So the next Senate-confirmed person in line is the Solicitor General. The Solicitor General may have a recusal problem in that he comes from the Jones Day law firm, which currently represents the Trump campaign. He can ask for a waiver from the White House, an ethics waiver that would waive his conflict of interest, which might be granted. On the other hand, if he doesn't get the waiver, then we have to go further down the line, and the head of the Office of Legal Counsel would be next in line to take over supervision of the investigation. So at this point, we don't know where it would actually land.
Well, Noel Francisco is a pretty conservative. He may be sympathetic to the White House. The Office of Legal Counsel in the DOJ, that deals with the executive branch itself, doesn't it? So he, what's his relationship with the White House counsel McGahn? I presume they work closely together, don't they?
Yes, they do. The Office of Legal Counsel is, in some sense, the law interpreter for the executive branch. So it issues opinions on legal issues and gives the White House legal advice. And in doing that, obviously, it works very closely with the White House counsel's office and with the White House counsel himself. And Stephen Engel is the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, and he was in the George W. Bush Justice Department. And in fact, there was some controversy over his confirmation because he had been involved in the production of some of the torture memoranda that came out of the Bush administration. But he was confirmed on a fairly close vote. Well, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of what he thinks about the Russian investigation. I think it's fair to assume that he would probably be more sympathetic to Trump than Rod Rosenstein has been.
Well, he sounds like he has a little bit of a similar resume to Judge Kavanaugh.
Yes, similar. I think it's worth pointing out, too, that the people who are in the line of succession have no experience as prosecutors. And obviously, it's very helpful to have a prosecutor overseeing a criminal investigation of this complexity and this sensitivity.
Well, it's very odd, though, to try and find out what the politics of this are, or at least, you know, read the tea leaves, Bill Yeomans. For example, when Rod Rosenstein showed up at the White House today, he was greeted outside of the gate by the chief of staff, General Kelly, who seemed to go out of his way to go on camera to show that he was sort of friendly and sympathetic, I guess. And then we find out that the real meeting is going to be on Thursday as to whether he is fired or resigned. And, of course, Thursday is supposed to be the day that the Kavanaugh hearing takes place with Dr. Ford testifying. But now there's a cloud over that because the Democrats are asking for the FBI to investigate a second charge that's emerged from a piece of investigation by The New Yorker. This has led, for example, Sean Hannity, the Fox News host, who's also apparently an informal advisor, if not an important advisor in this current White House. He's been cautioning Trump not to fire Rosenstein because he thinks that the whole thing is a setup. So, I mean, I don't know how can you pass the insanity of having talk show hosts essentially, you know, as presidential advisors, but this is what we have, right?
Right. Well, if we have a president who thinks of his administration as a TV show, then it makes a little bit more sense. There's all kinds of speculation about whether this is the timing of the Thursday meeting is calculated to take attention away from the Kavanaugh hearing, what? We just don't really know at this point what the calculations are. My guess is that the White House, for the reasons we've discussed, is eager to have Rosenstein announce that he is resigning rather than have to fire him on Thursday. And so it seems to me that the greeting by Kelly may have been to show that there were still cordial relations between the White House and Rosenstein, and they were not firing him, and to give him some room to agree to resignation. Beyond that, it's hard to speculate, except that I think we can be confident that Thursday is going to be a pretty amazing day, and in some respects, probably a historic day.
Well, it's obvious, though, that he was either going to be fired or resign. So they're the ones that seem to be putting pressure on Rosenstein.
Right. I think they would love, they want to put pressure on him. They want to get him to resign. Mm-hmm. Because that clears the space for Trump to put in his person in Rosenstein's position. If Rosenstein, though, may want to hang on, he may think it's his duty to stay and be fired. And to try to protect the investigation from someone from the outside coming in. At this point, that's all speculation.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Yeomans, who's a senior fellow for justice at the Alliance for Justice. He's also a lecturer at Columbia Law School and previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law, and also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice before assuming a series of management positions, including Acting Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Well, we don't know about the personalities involved, and how they think. Maybe you may well have a better handle on it than I do, but on the surface, I would think that Jeff Sessions has got to really be very unhappy with Trump and the way he's been treated. I just think that's obvious. But Rosenstein has not been treated much better. And apparently, initially, and this came out in the New York Times piece the other day, that what really was upsetting for Rosenstein and really threw him into a kind of emotional crisis was the fact that Trump went ahead and used his letter or his investigation into how Comey had mishandled the Hillary Clinton matter just before the elections, which Hillary Clinton blames on her loss of the presidency. That was used by Trump as an excuse to fire Comey, and apparently that really upset Rosenstein. So my sense is that there's no love lost here with Rosenstein and Trump.
No, I don't think there is. And we have heard this story that Rosenstein was upset. My question has always been what exactly Rosenstein expected. You know, he went to a meeting in the Oval Office, we were told, with Jeff Sessions the day before Comey was fired, and at which Trump, I'm sure, stated that he wanted to fire Comey. We're told that he had spent the weekend before that in Bedminster at his club fuming about firing Comey, and he came back to Washington intent on doing it. And so Rosenstein went back and wrote this memo. So it's always been my question, well, he wrote the memo. What did he expect it to be used for? I mean, it was a justification for firing Comey. It laid out the case against Comey for his mishandling of the Clinton email investigation in a very direct and convincing way. And I've always wondered what he expected to happen if he didn't expect Trump to use it as a basis for firing Comey. And that, of course, has complicated his status somewhat because he is potentially a witness in this investigation. To the extent that the firing of Comey is caught up in the obstruction of justice investigation, Rosenstein's role in the firing of Comey is obviously an important part of that Mueller needs to hear about. So I think that whole issue is confusing at this point. But I agree with you that since then there has been no love lost between Rosenstein and the president. And Trump has frequently tweeted ad hominem attacks on Rosenstein. So it would not surprise me at all to learn that Rosenstein would like to get out of his job. On the other hand, I have a sense that Rod Rosenstein is a serious public official who believes in public service and I think would feel some sense of responsibility to stay on if it's necessary to protect the investigation. So given all that, once again, Thursday is going to be a very interesting day.
Well, just in closing, though, the New York Times story, of course, it has exposed Rosenstein to the possibility of being fired or being forced to resign, talks about some pretty contentious meetings that took place shortly after Comey was fired, and the acting head of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, who Trump subsequently went after and managed to get fired literally the day before his pension became due in a very vindictive act. Andrew McCabe, it looks as if McCabe really went after Rosenstein for being the excuse to fire Comey. Is that your understanding?
It looks that way. I mean, McCabe produced memos, his contemporaneously drafted memos, and turned them over. And I think that was much of the basis for the story here. So, it does. it's a complicated scenario. There was clearly tension within the department and with the department and the FBI, and then with all of those people in the White House. And I think we are coming toward a denouement.
Well, just in closing, though, if you look through the list of the people that Trump's attacked and tried to have fired and tried to humiliate on Twitter, Sessions, Rosenstein, McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, the top intelligence officials that briefed him on January the 6th, 2 weeks before he was inaugurated. The former head of the FBI, of course, is gone, Comey. The former head of the CIA, he's an enemy number one of Trump's. The former director of national intelligence is another public enemy number one of Trump's. It's hardly a coincidence, isn't it, that all the key people, and now, of course, they've gone after Bruce Orr, who happens to be the FBI's number one expert on Russian organized crime, and we know that money laundering and the involvement of Russian organized crime in funding Trump and buying 1,300 condos from Trump. All of that stuff raises some serious questions with me.
Oh, I think it's an incredibly damning picture. You know, it is clear that Trump is fighting as hard as possible to protect himself and to suppress this investigation and to disable the people who are investigating him. And, you know, this has been called a slow-moving Saturday night massacre, but it's even more extensive than a Saturday night massacre because, as you point out, it has gone through the intelligence agencies, through the FBI, through the Department of Justice, and almost anybody who has been in a position to have the goods on Trump has been fired, except for Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein at this point. Again, as I say, I think we're headed toward a denouement.
Well, Bill Yeomans, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I very much appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Yeomans, who's a senior fellow for justice at the Alliance for Justice. He's also a lecturer at Columbia Law School and previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at the American University's Washington College of Law, and also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice before assuming a series of management positions, including acting Assistant Attorney General of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's apparent determination to plow through with Thursday's hearings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org And joining us now is Lena Schwarenstein, who is the Fair Courts Campaign Director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as the Director of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lena Schwarenstein.
Thank you, Ian.
And it's hard to make sense of what's happening here today. It's been a bit, obviously been a confusing and rather extraordinary news day with the Deputy Attorney General going to the White House and rumors that he was about to be fired or resign. But, of course, the New Yorker did come out with this story about the second woman at Yale who claims to have been assaulted by the Judge Kavanaugh in a rather graphic way that we won't get into. There's also a third woman now coming forth via Michael Avenatti, who apparently, and she has apparently has a pretty high-level security clearance, so she may well be a credible witness. So how do you see this thing as we move towards Thursday? Do you think that the calls by Senator Feinstein for an FBI investigation, now that there's two, possibly three women, you'd think at some point or other the Republicans would have to give in to the logic of doing that?
I would hope so. It certainly would be in their best interest. The people who are prepared and equipped to actually do a full investigation is not the Senate Judiciary Committee, but it is the FBI. They do these background investigations in which they can get to the bottom of a number of allegations and different aspects of this that I think would really help the senators be able to understand all of the information that's out there and not be limited to just, say, two witnesses that may be in front of them, which is what we're anticipating to happen on Thursday. So it really should be the investigation should be conducted by people who are trauma-informed and who are actually equipped to investigate this.
But when you say two witnesses on Thursday, that is Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh, not the second woman from Yale, Ramirez.
That's correct. As far as we know right now, it's only Dr. Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh who will be testifying on Thursday and answering the senator's questions. And there's, you know, certainly calls, and Deborah Ramirez should be heard as well if she's willing and able to do so. But so far right now for Thursday, the Senate majority is rushing ahead and making sure that, you know, Judge Kavanaugh is testifying on Thursday.
So is there any indication at this point of whether the wavering women, or at least they're considered to be wavering in the sense that both Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins have said that they will not nominate a judge or vote for the confirmation of a judge who would overturn Roe v. Wade. They've gotten assurances from the candidate, Brett Kavanaugh, that he wouldn't and that it's settled law. But there's a lot of skepticism about whether or not he really believes that, particularly with the case that many of the senators asked about that happened on the border with a 17-year-old girl. So it seems like the latest evidence is kind of piling on in the sense that it's going to be – do you think it's going to be increasingly difficult for these two women, these two Republican women, to vote to confirm Kavanaugh?
It shouldn't be only hard for Senators Collins and Murkowski. It should be hard for every single senator to actually look their constituents, many of whom are sexual assault survivors themselves, and seriously take a vote on Kavanaugh while this cloud is over him. And I will say, and you've mentioned specifically that, you know, Senators Collins and Murkowski seem to be, although I'm not 100% convinced that they are, completely assured that Judge Kavanaugh has convinced them that he would not be the fifth and decisive vote to overturn Roe. That's contrary to, I think, what Kavanaugh himself has said, as you've mentioned, with the Garza case and his decision in there, and the fact that he issued that decision just like a few weeks before he was put on the short list and that President Trump selected him from, that was curated by the Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation. So he's gone through, and I think this goes to his credibility. It's not just on whether or not he would be a vote to help gut and or overturn Roe. it really goes to all of the other questions about his credibility, about using stolen files to help the White House have an advantage on some very controversial judicial nominees, his involvement in domestic surveillance programs, and so on. I think that was repeated throughout his confirmation hearing, actually back in 2004 and 2006, and really came to the top, I think, with his testimony that he gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee and in his evasive and non-responsive answers and his questions for the record, the written questions afterwards. So really, Kavanaugh has a significant credibility problem already that has really been compounded by these recent allegations. I would hope that, you know, Senators Murkowski, Collins, but every senator knows that we are all watching them and what they do in this moment. If they rush to a vote before a full and fair FBI investigation is done into these allegations, that really the public will hold them accountable, and that it's really unacceptable that they would do something so partisan and so rushed, which would be detrimental not only to the Senate as an institution and the process by which they should be thoroughly vetting nominees, especially those for lifetime appointments, but also degrading to the entire institution that is the Supreme Court.
And again, I'm speaking with Lena Schwanstein, who is the Fair Courts Campaign Director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as a director of strategic engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. Well, there's apparently some reports now coming out of the White House that some of the president's allies are advising him to nominate Amy Coney Barrett, who was on the short list. Apparently, Trump is telling people that he's, even though publicly, of course, at the UN today, he endorsed and said he's standing by Judge Kavanaugh. Apparently, he's telling people privately that he never really wanted Kavanaugh in the first place. He wanted Judge Thomas Hardiman, who his sister, Marianne Trump Barry, had recommended since she worked with him side by side on the federal bench. So what do you make of those rumors?
Well, it's hard to say. I think right now we have to focus on exactly what's in front of him. We are very much determined to make sure that Kavanaugh's full record and that this investigation actually be conducted. And if not, every senator has to vote no. And then we can turn to whether or not we might be entertaining anyone else that was selected and put onto that short list, which Kavanaugh was plucked from. We really can't put the cart before the horse on this one. So I'm afraid to speculate. It seems right now that they are doing everything that they can to rush this nominee through confirmation, hoping that the public maybe doesn't notice, but we're noticing and we're watching and we're really outraged that the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate majority are not taking this seriously. It's really up to, Chairman Grassley to defend, I think the thorough process that the committee used to abide by in evaluating Supreme Court nominees. You know, I think that this is something that if sexual assault allegations are brushed under the rug, it's something that women are watching and will hold them accountable for.
So when the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, says the other day, as he did before, the faith community, who of course are hugely behind Kavanaugh, and that there's a concern apparently amongst Republican strategists that if Kavanaugh goes down, the religious right, who are so much behind him, will be demoralized and won't show up in November, and that's the sort of subtext for this obvious rushing that's going on. In fact, of course, McConnell said to them, it'll happen and we will plow through. So that seems to be rather inflammatory language if you're trying to be sort of sensitive at this moment, and if you don't want to lose what remaining Republican women are out there that are likely to vote in November, because the assumption is that that's where the Republicans are vulnerable with women. And I imagine at this point, things are getting worse, aren't they?
They sure seem to be. And I would say that it's not just insensitive that he would make these remarks, but it's really harmful. The things that he is doing to rush this confirmation, to really tarnish the reputations of these women who have made credible sexual assault allegations against a very powerful man, it really serves to silence women and survivors who may not be ready to tell their own story or bring charges, and really sends the absolute wrong message to survivors of sexual assault. And that's not something that's partisan. Sexual assault, obviously, is something that affects women and men and people all across the country of all, you know, political backgrounds. And so what he's saying to that he will plow through confirmation is really reprehensible. And I think it's interesting to note that, you know, there were rumors, and obviously Dr. Blasey Ford's story had already been out there, and there were rumors about Deborah Ramirez's. And instead of saying we need to have a full and fair, independent, nonpartisan investigation conducted by the FBI, his instinct was to push the gas pedal and accelerate on this. And that is really inexcusable. And it's not only insensitive, it really does significant damage, I think, to those of us who are survivors and who are really watching this entire process. It really makes me wonder, what are they afraid of? When, you know, back, if we go back in time to the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing in 1991, Anita Hill, her allegations were investigated by the FBI. She was allowed to have outside witnesses come and defend not only her character, but explain workplace harassment. None of those things are right now are being afforded to Dr. Blasey Ford or Deborah Ramirez. And that really is absolutely appalling. So not only do they not want to grant those minimal, sort of requests that the survivors have made, they're all they're trying to do is silence these particular women and all other survivors.
And again, I'm speaking with Alina Schwarnstein, who is the Fair Courts Campaign Director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as the Director of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. So, I mean, do we know what's going to happen on Thursday in terms of the format? You know, because obviously the witness, Dr. Blasey Ford, through her lawyers has tried to, she wanted to go second after the testimony by Judge Kavanaugh that was shot down. There was some talk that maybe the all-male Republican Senate Judiciary Committee questioners will sort of take a powder and have a female staffer ask the questions. Do we know what kind of format it's going to be on Thursday?
I'm not going to say with 100% certainty, but in addition to them not slowing down the process and actually allowing for a full and fair investigation by the FBI, it seems like they are denying Dr. Blasey Ford's request. And so, as you've mentioned, you know, in order to assure her safety and practicing just minimal, some trauma-informed standards, they so far have denied outside witnesses, meaning that it will only be Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey Ford actually being the ones who testify. My understanding at the moment is that it will be Dr. Blasey Ford testifying first and then allowing Judge Kavanaugh to go second in order to defend himself. He's obviously doing a prebuttal tonight on Fox News, where he will be, I'm sure, making an appeal to the public. And then so he will have plenty of opportunities to be speaking. And as you said, it sounds to me like despite the fact that the Senate Judiciary Committee Republicans have claimed that they are the ones that are equipped to do an investigation and not the FBI, that they are deferring all of their responsibility to an outside counsel. I think it's important to note that this is not a trial, certainly not a trial for Dr. Blasey Ford. This is really a job interview where the senator should be the ones who are able to ask questions, but perhaps they're too afraid of misstepping, as they have already done so much in the press. Which is why they have to outsource this important role. I think that is not only cowardly, it is something where they are shirking the responsibilities that they claim that they and they alone have.
But she also, Dr. Blasey Ford, wanted this fellow, Mark Judge, who she claims was a participant, not just a witness, to the sexual assault that she's alleging Brett Kavanaugh conducted when she was in high school and he was a 17-year-old high school kid at a party in a house off campus, obviously. So, I mean, if you look into Mark Judge's record, his background and his writings, he became a conservative author and filmmaker. It's almost the milieu in which he describes life at Georgetown Prep, which is, you know, binge drinking, and he refers to one character in one of his books as Bart O'Kavanaugh, who threw up in somebody's car because he couldn't stagger home, and being blind drunk all the time, etc. That would seem to me to be relevant in terms of setting a context. And why do you, what was the reasoning for not having him? Because he's both accused of being a participant, and secondly, he seems like a witness to describe what was going on in the life of a 17-year-old Brett Kavanaugh.
I think it's remarkable that Dr. Blasey Ford has not only courageously stepped forward to say that she's willing to testify, but she has brought further scrutiny upon her and herself, her story and her allegations, and has actually called upon others who have vital information, things that the FBI ideally would be the ones who would be able to investigate. And when that's not allowed, not having other people who would be witnesses, I think that that says even more that there is something more that, you know, the Senate Republicans are trying to hide. You've described already a little bit about the culture of the prep school that both Mark Judge and Kavanaugh went to, Georgetown Prep. That's been detailed in a lot of news stories. Kavanaugh himself has said what happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep. And it's known to be, you know, very have a lot of heavy drinking, and there's a lot of, if you just even read the yearbook, a lot of very misogynistic phrases in there. It really causes a lot of concern, not only for what the culture was like, but certainly means that there should be much more thorough scrutiny over, you know, what may have happened, both at Georgetown Prep, but then also with Deborah Ramirez's allegations at Yale. You know, she also noted, and a number of people have commented who were surrounding the actual experience incident that she describes in her allegations, as well as you know, friends nearby that she may have talked to, and so on. These are all people that the FBI should be talking to, not the press. I mean, not certainly senators, but they're not, the senators aren't even doing doing that outreach and having them be called to testify on Thursday. And that's a sign that they're afraid that this will hurt the credibility of their witness, whose credibility is already in question.
Well, just to, the latest update is that two of Brett Kavanaugh's classmates have withdrawn from the statement his lawyers issued disputing Deborah Ramirez's account of what happened at Yale.
That's right.
And the two are, of course, implicated in the incident, according to her. And a third one is married to the guy that who she recalls saying, kiss it, at the party. And the it that we're referring to is the I don't know how I can say it on the air, but an organ that was being publicly and flagrantly displayed belonging to Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, it's when people who have come out in support suddenly read more of the details and I think can say, hey, we need to stop and this should be more fully investigated, it's time that the Senate Republicans listen to them and listen to survivors and do what's right and try to, if they really want to clear Kavanaugh's name, and provide some legitimacy, not only for their institution, but for the Supreme Court, make sure that a full investigation is done before the Senate Judiciary Committee asks questions of Kavanaugh or any of the survivors.
Just mentioned to you, Lena, that on today's program we spoke earlier with Congressman Ted Lieu, who is calling upon the House Judiciary Committee to initiate an investigation into these allegations and determine whether Judge Kavanaugh should keep his current job, which is on the appeals court, or whether there are grounds for impeachment. So given that in the hearing, the Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii asked Judge Kavanaugh bluntly, you know, about sexual harassment and asked him a question that she said she asks all nominees, where do you think it stands? I mean, it sounds like he may not just be in jeopardy in terms of this current job that he's up for, but the very job that he has now.
Kavanaugh certainly has a credibility problem. It's important that we focus on this week because Kavanaugh is coming into this hearing on Thursday with an incredible credibility problem. And so that certainly impacts whether or not he gets a promotion to join the Supreme Court, something that each senator right now should be fully evaluating and honestly waiting for an FBI investigation to be complete. And if that's not even going to be issued, every single senator should be opposing this nomination. And then we can turn to, I think, whether or not it makes sense for the House Judiciary Committee to do a further investigation. Obviously, I think the congressman raises some significant concerns that we have had in 2004 in his hearing, in 2006, and most recently. But right now, we need to be making sure that we are focused, on a lifetime appointment to our highest court before we can discuss, you know, whether or not he's fit to serve on the D.C. Circuit.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lena Schwarnstein.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Lena Schwarnstein, who is the Fair Courts Campaign Director at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who previously served as the Director of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society, where she oversaw the organization's work on judicial nominations and why courts matter. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.